Welcome back to the USCHoops.com College Basketball Podcast. This is the May 30th, 2022 edition. The USCHoops.com College Basketball Podcast is the original podcast covering the USC Trojans men's college basketball team and is available on such platforms as Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, Google Podcast, and TuneIn, as well as at the USCHoops.com website. If you haven't done so already, we'd really appreciate it if you gave us a five-star rating and left a review on the platform of your choice. This is your co-host, Chase, as always, joined by Nick. Nick, how are you doing?
Chase, hanging in there with the Houston summer has kind of fully hit us down here. I'm sure you're seeing that in Arizona as well.
Yeah, we're still in this little transition period where it's like pretty brutal during the day, but like once you can kind of hide from it, especially in the evenings, get in a little bit of a shade. But you know, we're coming into the months where you can't really hide at all. You know, it's just kind of brutal for about 2 months straight here. Not just hot, but like hot all the time.
Sure. No, I can imagine. Now we kind of have it where you can get out in the mornings a little bit, like kind of before 10, and then after 10, just forget it, really.
Yeah.
So yeah, definitely kind of have to pick your battles there.
Yeah. So we're doing a little bit, something different today. We're not really going to talk about basketball. There hasn't been a ton of basketball news. And I think unless something's changed in the last few hours, we're still waiting on whether or not Drew Peterson and Boogie Ellis are going to be withdrawing from the draft. Certainly no new players have committed to SC out of the transfer portal. So, once the decisions are made, we'll probably have another podcast pretty soon, right after start of next month. But today we are going to talk about USC football, my original love, and obviously, the most popular sport at the University of Southern California, and really one of the most popular sports in some ways on the West Coast and, in college football for sure. So this is just a crazy transition. I know we touched upon this before, but leading up, what did you think was going to happen leading up to the naming of a new coach before, the tweet that came out, I think from Bruce Feldman, which might have been Pete Thamel, one of the two floated the Lincoln Riley name. And the moment I saw that name floated from one of those two guys, as I've said repeatedly on the podcast, that means there's something super real to this, just like when they floated the Jordan Addison thing. So what did you think when in those moments leading up before Lincoln Riley's name was mentioned, what did you think USC would do?
Yeah, it's a great question. I know Matt Campbell's name had traction in kind of that prior 48-hour stretch, and I kind of thought that with Campbell's name losing some steam, they may have had some traction with somebody else. So I know like the Peristyle, which is the biggest blog out there, touching on USC football. Those guys were all losing their minds. They thought they lost Matt Campbell, and there was a lot of people that wanted a Lane Kiffin reunion at USC at that point, which is pretty hilarious for a multitude of reasons. But I was fairly optimistic they would get something done with a bigger name. I didn't think it would be Riley. I guess Riley made sense in the context that he just lost his final game on that Saturday. So it really fit the timeline of, okay, if Campbell was going to, if he was losing steam and Riley's season ended on that Saturday night, then, you can kind of connect the dots there. And it was obvious, although like in the moment, you can't really like see that because, if you would have told me before the search that Lincoln Riley would have interest in USC, I would have told you were insane. Like he had a good thing going at Oklahoma. I think he was making $7+ million. Obviously just a monumental hire for the program. And I know like going into it, Riley has his flaws in terms of, he's never had a great defense. So there were like people that were even advocating for Matt Campbell over Lincoln Riley. And what I think that, right. Right. Yeah. So that was a fun time where, you had the Campbell truthers, advocating for him over Riley. And I think what they failed to realize just the instant juice that Riley would give recruiting in the program. And he certainly has. So just kind of a crazy stretch in terms of, people wondering what would happen with the coaching search. You might have more insight into how everything went down, but pretty shocking, right? The whole
I was completely shocked. I learned only in retrospect did I learn any information, which is there had been back channel discussions with Riley that had been going on, which I did not know about when the Campbell thing fell through. I just thought this was just SC dropping the ball again, and I didn't think it was going to be another Clay Helton situation, but Lane Kiffin, I would not have been surprised. I would not have been surprised. So the remarkable thing here about the USC football tradition, which is certainly one of the top, let's say, five programs of all time. I think before the renaissance of Alabama under Nick Saban, you could really argue that it had gone to the point where it was just USC, Notre Dame, number one, number two. Now, Alabama's really put themselves in there as probably the top program of all time because of what they've accomplished the last 14 years. But the top football programs in college football, I think it's objectively, if you just look at the numbers, it's Alabama, Notre Dame, USC, Oklahoma, and Ohio State. All the other programs that get discussed, I mean, there are some really great programs, but those five, if you look like just objective statistics, they stick out in terms of, you know, not only all-time wins, but bowl wins, major bowl wins, national championships, Heisman winners, NFL draft picks. There's always those kind of names being, those schools being discussed virtually in all of those categories. But USC, since the hire of Howard Jones in 1940, that's when Howard Jones stopped coaching USC. Howard Jones was actually hired in 1925. So when Howard Jones was hired, he was hired, I think, at the recommendation of Newt Rockne, and had a really sterling reputation as a coach. He coached at Iowa and then for a season at Duke. That is, I believe, the last time USC hired a head coach from a different program that had any type of success at, you know, let's say the top level in its history, other than coaches who had prior relationships with USC. So Lane Kiffin was hired from Tennessee, but he'd already been a coach at USC. So Steve Sarkisian was hired from Washington. He'd already been a coach at USC. Ted Tolner had already been a coach at USC. Oh, there's one other. So it's Howard Jones and Larry Smith. Larry Smith had been a coach at Arizona, had done well there, not supremely well, but well enough to get noticed. SC poached him. And Larry Smith did have some very good years early on before things kind of fell apart. But SC just doesn't do this kind of stuff. Even SC's legendary coach prior to Pete Carroll, John McKay, he was brought on by the existing coach at the time, Don Clark, who he was not the athletic director. I think Jess Hill was the athletic director, but Don Clark brought John McKay on from Oregon, and they didn't really have coaching designations back then, but John McKay had been kind of like the offensive coordinator for Oregon. Oregon had some really good seasons leading up to that point. They had won a Rose Bowl, and Don Clark brought him in and then retired after 1 year and convinced the school, against many objections, to appoint McKay after just being at SC for 1 year as the head coach. But McKay had never been a head coach before himself. So he was brought in from the outside, but had not actually been a head coach, and he'd only been at SC for 1 year. The hiring of Lincoln Riley, I mean, the only thing that's even close to this is Howard Jones. I mean, Lincoln Riley is one of the top four most successful college football coaches of the last 5 years, I think almost by any metric. If it's not top four, top five, I mean, you pick it, but pretty much top four. Now the defensive has not always been stellar, but his offensive have, you know, many times been number one overall. He's producing Heisman winners. To get a coach of that caliber to come to USC is completely unprecedented, especially to come from a program like Oklahoma, which is, like I said, really belongs in the discussion of one of the top programs of all time. So it was pretty amazing. I was completely, I remember listening to this. In fact, I can remember exactly where I was on driving and listening to this on the radio, just completely blown away. So yes, I knew the moment that happened that at a minimum, and by the way, going into that, like I said, I had written things off a little bit. I thought, well, you know, Lane Kiffin comes back. He's learned some lessons. I still think he doesn't have the right character to be the head coach you want, but Lincoln Riley is going to make a tremendous, tremendous impact when it comes to the kind of personnel he's able to bring in. And boy, has he ever. So I guess we can talk about that a little bit, but what were your impressions when he was hired? I mean, other than the fact that, you know, there were people, you know, doing the truther stuff on Peristyle.
Yeah. Just kind of shocked about the whole thing and how quickly it kind of went down. Right. Cause like, as soon as I think it was Feldman, dropped the, like, USC is, you know, interested in Lincoln Riley, like they had kind of the reports of the deal being done like within an hour. Right. So like that all just pretty much when they tipped off Bruce about it, they basically were signing the contract. And then, you know, they didn't want any, you know, they didn't want any leaks on that, and they did a really good job. I mean, hiding it, right?
Like, they
I
don't did. Think
anybody had Riley pegged as a serious candidate before that Sunday where he was hired. Like it was all, you know, Campbell, kind of to a lesser extent, Fickle, right? Chris Peterson was an early candidate, but not really a serious candidate, I don't think. And you had the Kiffin stuff out there, like, oh, Kiffin would take the job, right? So he was like the floor of the search, like, oh, it can always circle back to Kiffin or whatever. So, and then you had like the weird like NFL names, like Eric Bieniemy, which was, you know, talk about what would have been a disappointment compared to Lincoln Riley. I mean, holy
smokes. Yeah, and there's, I mean, just, I don't want to go too far down that tunnel, but that was, you know, Bieniemy, I mean, whatever the situation is with Bieniemy, he still can't get an NFL job. You would think he'd be very highly sought after at this point. Can't get an NFL job.
Yeah.
But he was, you know, he was at Colorado as the offensive coordinator there, and they really, really, really struggled. And I didn't see any indication that he was ready for promotion, let alone, yeah, you know, to even to be at a school like USC with a promotion. So, yeah, that was scary. I mean, just, yeah, it's amazing the difference.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think, you know, you got to give the Bone, Sozna, Brain Trust a lot of credit for that. And Caruso, like, you know, I kind of wonder, is the reason that he put up the money to fund the hire because he was running for mayor? So like, is the reason that Lincoln Riley's the head coach of USC right now, is that just because of Rick Caruso's mayoral ambitions? It kind of makes you wonder, right, about that whole thing.
I think it's very hard to argue there's not some sort of connection, put it that way.
Yeah.
I mean, certainly if he's running for mayor and he can look to his real estate record, but, you know, generally real estate developers don't do great. I know we just had a president who was a real estate developer,
yeah,
but right, generally speaking, real estate developers don't do tremendously in politics themselves. You know, unlike the former president, Caruso didn't like stick his name on all his real estate projects. So people, right, would not have necessarily immediately known who he was. He certainly wasn't like a celebrity like Trump was. So this, right, is like, he's kind of an obscure figure. He had been on the board as the chairman of the board at USC. I mean, that is kind of a political position, and right, there had been problems there. Now that the problems really don't, he didn't, you know, as his chairmanship, the problems didn't happen during his chairmanship, but he was kind of like in a position to like kind of having to solve them. And it's not clear that that was getting done. Then you bring in Riley and all of a sudden everything looks like, you know, everything looks roses.
Yeah. Now it definitely kind of flipped around his reputation, because I know, like, you know, at least the reputation, Caruso's reputation among the student body, like when I was there, like it's, there were a lot of things, you know, it wasn't great. I mean, there was a lot of frustration with him, with a multitude of issues from, the transition amongst across several of the university presidents to, Dean Ellis's firing at the business school. I mean, there were like, there weren't the issues that there were under Nikias per se that were super visible and out in the open, but there was a lot of frustration with Caruso and the way the university was going. And, funding the Riley hire is a really good way to kind of quickly flip the script on that. So not that like, the Caruso's reputation among the USC student body is going to dictate whether he wins LMA or not, because that's a small cross section of the electorate. But, I think it did build up a little bit of goodwill in among the donor class, at least. And he seems to have some momentum in the polling right now. I know from the people I know out in LA, he's carpet bombing the airwaves with ads. And he just passed 50% in betting markets to win the mayorship. So there's some serious traction there in terms of him winning the mayorship. But it's just ironic that it may have taken one guy's mayoral ambitions to revive a once great program from the dead. It's pretty funny when you think about it that way.
Yeah, it is pretty funny and it's pretty amazing. Well, okay, so... Lincoln Riley's in there now, and we had talked last time we really talked about football. We talked about Jason Dart and how we thought, oh gosh, this guy, as he's got another star quarterback, is he going to save Clay Helton's job? But then he, kind of lucky for us, he got a little dinged up. I think he's going to fully recover. That was not an issue, but he wasn't there to rescue Clay Helton. But heading into the offseason, it's like a legitimate issue that you've got this guy who's probably the most sought after, the most kind of valuable player as far as, just in the open market on the team is this quarterback who is just, played as a freshman, had a spectacular beginning, got dinged up, came back and didn't have all the pizzazz, and probably because he was trying to not make sure he doesn't get hurt. And then there's like immediately rumors bubbling up that, oh, well, actually Lincoln Riley's freshman quarterback from Oklahoma is interested in transferring and joining Riley at SC. And I have to say, like, I don't know. I mean, Caleb Williams overall had like a better, season than Dart, but I don't know if Williams had any one game that he was better than how Dart looked against Washington State. That was kind of the dilemma. Like Dart, I mean, I think Dart's a faster player. He's not as thick physically. So I think, with Williams, you're getting someone who's going to be more durable. But Dart looks like he might have like kind of in a way almost more elite athleticism, which is, not what you necessarily expect in the situation. And it was kind of like, not completely clear. Do we really want to make this change, especially since we kind of had to like commit to not having Dart ahead of time, let him transfer out of the program, which happened, and then hope that Caleb Williams came in? Well, everything has turned out tremendously, right? So Williams does come in. His teammate from Oklahoma's receiver, Mario Williams, who's a freshman, who looks pretty an interesting prospect. He had a pretty decent freshman season. He comes along, and then out of almost nowhere, we get word that the reigning Biletnikoff winner, Jordan Addison from Pitt, wants to come and join Caleb Williams at SC. So the one thing we can say for sure is, and we should probably talk about the Beats deal and the NIL deal. Caleb Williams was able to put that together from kind of an outside, it was not a booster arranged or some sort of collective arranged NIL. It might've been booster arranged, but we don't know about it, but it wasn't a collective arranged NIL. It seems pretty clear that Dart was not going to be able to recruit players to SC the way that Caleb Williams has.
Yeah, I think that's part of it. And Williams is dual threat. Like I think Williams probably has better straight line speed than Dart if you just like tested them out running a 40, but Dart's a little bit bigger, so he can kind of run over guys more. He's kind of built like Tim Tebow in a way. Not quite that big.
I think Williams has more, a little more wiggle, a little more kind of like side to side.
Yeah,
I think straight ahead, I think Dart is probably faster than Williams is my guess.
That'd be interesting. And like maybe, Dart, he was playing on a torn meniscus too. So I think like he might not have been 100%, right? So that might have been a factor. But I thought Williams' flashes were pretty freaking good too last year. Like he came off the bench against Texas, went 16 to 25 for 212 in that come from behind win where they won 55-48. They were kind of dead when they had Rattler in and Williams just kind of juiced it. And they came back. That was really good. Not to mention the bowl game against Oregon, who was one of the tougher defenses in the Pac-12. And yeah, the Pac-12 is terrible. So, you know, you got to keep that in mind. But he went 21 of 27, so 78% completion percentage, three touchdowns, no picks, and they're 34 rushing. So he ran for 442 on the year. So, you know, he definitely has the scrambling capability. I don't think he's like, he's nowhere near the twitch athlete that like Kyler Murray is, but kind of more in the Baker Mayfield, I think, level of mobility, maybe like a little bit twitchier than Baker, but Baker can move a little bit too. Definitely not a statue like Matt Barkley, for instance. Like he can
there's no question about that.
So more athleticism there. You mentioned Mario Williams, former five-star recruit out of Florida, had a pretty good freshman year. That receiving room was pretty good at OU. So he was playing second field to Marvin Mims and a couple of those other guys. But I think he's the second most talented guy on USC. He might even have a little bit more explosiveness than Jordan Addison, but Addison is just very consistent and an outstanding route runner. And has great hands. So Addison is not really a freak physically, but he just kind of knows how to get open and catch the ball really well. So it's a heck of a, you know, wide receiver room now, because you got those guys, you got Gary Bryant, you got Jerry Rice's kid, Brendan Rice from Colorado, who's he's very physically gifted. So they got guys. I mean, it's, you know, the team's got holes for sure, but it won't be at the receiver position. They don't have like a Alabama of a few years ago caliber of receiving room where they had four first round picks with, you know, Henry Ruggs, Jerry Jeudy, Devontae Smith, and Jalen Waddle. But, it's easily the best receiving core in the Pac-12 and maybe the best in the country.
Yeah. Actually, I mean, it's funny because, you know, this was, I think his name is Josh Pate, the commentator that works for CBS and 247 had said that he thought it was, you know, the best receiver room USC's had in years. But the truth is, if you just wind the clock back just a few seasons, SC had on one team, Michael Pittman, Amon-Ra St. Brown, Tyler Vaughns, and Drake London. So that was a pretty healthy crop of receivers. I don't think this group is as good as that group, but it's got a lot of guys that I think we don't know how good they can be because a lot of them are young. Some of them have transferred. We don't really, you know, like we don't know how good like a Gary Bryant Jr. is going to be. He's kind of a wild card a little bit. You know, I think we have a pretty good idea about Taj Washington, but maybe in a Lincoln Riley system with Caleb Williams back there, it's just, there's more consistency and maybe we'll see stuff we haven't seen before. So,
And he's like the fifth guy, right? Like he was like the number two guy last year.
Right. And after London got hurt, he was the number one guy.
Right. Right. So, and so you kind of, you know, he used to move from like a one to a five. I mean, and that kind of says a lot because he's not like a horrible player, but definitely, you know, not like a Drake London, Jordan Addison, Marquise Lee type at all.
Well, right? he's not like, you don't, he doesn't look like a necessarily like an NFL player, right? That's
right.
So that's the thing, you know, SC had been used to having all these NFL receivers. I think, look, SC got a lifeline here. I mean, this is the situation was going to get really, really, really bad really, really quickly. I mean, SC was terrible this past season. But it was actually probably going to get worse because there was going to be so much pressure placing a guy like Dart. He was probably going to keep getting hurt every season because he would have been asked to do way too much. He would not have been supported by an adequate running game. The receivers that were left were not good enough to do things like on their own, make plays on their own, take pressure off of him. I mean, this is the kind of reversal of fortune here is just off the charts.
Yeah.
Especially, you know, and not just the passing game, because now we also, SC has running backs that have entered the fray. I mean, to have a guy like Travis Dye transfer over from Oregon, I mean, Dye's not going to be the greatest running back of all time, but he's a reliable guy that you, if you, you know, block for him, you give him the right offense, you know, he's going to give you, you know, he's going to give you the, you know, 80 to 110 yards a game if you give him the ball about 20 times, you know, just depending on how you're looking.
Yeah. Yeah. No, he's a really good player. Was really productive up there. He's not really like a pro prospect, but might be the best running back in the Pac-12. Certainly up there with probably a few of the Utah guys and Charbonnet at UCLA. Like, he's really, really good player, and they like, he's clearly better than anyone they had. Right. I guess Ingram was, I liked Ingram a lot, good player, but you know, he was gone. So, certainly better than any of their returnees. So yeah, I mean, you know, with him and the Riley scheme, Riley actually does run the ball a good amount. It kind of has a reputation of, you know, being like a pass heavy guy, just given the amount of quarterback talent that's gone through Oklahoma, but he's run the ball. Definitely, you know, is more reliant on the run game than a lot of these other spread guys for sure.
Yeah, no, his, and whatever you want to call his offense, it's not the same as like the Mike Leach offense, which there was some version of that SC had been trying to run for the last few years. And this is not that. This is going to be a different kind of offense. You're going to see it's much more hard-nosed. And, you know, we've seen it from Oklahoma. I mean, they can run the ball and pass the ball with great proficiency when Lincoln Riley's been the coach. So, I mean, you know, there's issue, the offensive line looks it looks pretty good, but very thin. Worry you about injuries in that case. I don't think you want the offensive line to like be the foundation of your offense, which I know that kind of like is jarring to some people, but really, if you run the right offense, you have the right quarterback, you have weapons that you can distribute, that helps out the offensive line a lot. And you also have a quarterback. You have a quarterback who is not going to get easily sacked. He's elusive. So that's going to take pressure off the offensive line too. So depending on the health, you know, I think SC's offense could be really, really productive, mainly not just, you know, the personnel is in place, but then you got Lincoln Riley with the personnel and the combination of those things. And, you know, even going back to the time period when, you know, SC had, you know, Lane Kiffin the first time around. Well, there was an issue back then, which was Kiffin had not kind of like gotten out of his fixation with running almost like a 90s style offense. He hadn't really made that full adjustment to running a more modern offense. And that happened when he got to Florida Atlantic and Kendall Briles came on his staff and basically just shook up the offense. And Kiffin has been running that offense ever since to great effect. So SC's hasn't really had this combination of kind of like really nice offensive kind of scheme, to, for lack of a better term, with, you know, the personnel, that because SC's had the personnel, but they haven't really had the scheme, but really since the Norm Chow days, you know? So this is going to be an interesting combination. I don't think the talent level, I think if you were to just go purely based on talent, SC has had better talent at different times in recent years, for sure. Even on offense, even with all these transfers at the wide receiver, SC's had better talent in prior years. But you get the combination of the right quarterback, you've got some pieces that he could work with at receiver and a running back, and you got Lincoln Riley in there. And I think that combination really right away is going to be pretty effective.
Yeah, and I think you got to also factor in the level of the Pac-12, right? Like, it's really weak league. Like, you know, we can kind of go game by game on the schedule, like later in the podcast and talk about that. But you compare like the level of USC schedule compared to, you know, the SEC, it's just not even close, right? So I actually think USC has a pretty good chance to make the playoff this year. I don't know about you, but I just look at the weakness of their schedule, and it's pretty easy to see them going 11-1 with these games for sure.
Well, it's possible. I've been preaching patience as much as possible. And I mean, it's a weird situation because the league is incredibly weak. I mean, so weak that obviously during the COVID season, Clay Helton was able to essentially, you know, run the Pac-12 South with, you know,
with Keaton Slovis.
Like, now he had an amazing wide receiver core. Don't get me wrong, but you know, that was a team that if they were playing in the SEC, probably would have finished below 500, especially since I don't think the SEC had like that many out of conference games. So they would have been playing only conference games and, you know, Helton went 5-0. So yeah, I mean, there's a lot to be said about that. And actually it's probably something we need to discuss on future podcasts is what's the future here? Because
yeah,
it's not clear what the commitment is on the West Coast to major college football. And that's going to tie in with the NIL situation, obviously, but it's pretty dire, it seems to me. I mean, I guess because of what happened with the COVID season and only playing the five games, now the Pac-12 has fallen behind even the ACC in terms of conference revenue. That's not a good sign. The ACC is a basketball conference. There aren't really many programs in the ACC that have any kind of underlying football history that the fans care a lot about. Yeah, yes, you have Clemson, you got Florida State, and then you got Miami, which has the most fickle of fans. But then you've got a lot of programs like Duke and North Carolina and Virginia. These are not programs where Wake Forest, these are not programs where there's like a tremendous interest in football in general. These are essentially, it's basketball country, and that's what they care about. And the Pac-12 with Los Angeles and San Francisco and Phoenix and Seattle and Portland is falling behind. That's in revenue. I mean, that's a really bad thing. Now, maybe that will get strained out now that COVID's over, but I mean, there's just, it's looking more and more like the West Coast does not want to participate in major college football.
Yeah, I think there's some of that, but also like how much of that has to do with Larry Scott and the TV deal, right? Like if that gets renegotiated, wouldn't that straighten a good amount of this out?
Well, if they can get the right deal, that's an issue. Can they get the right deal?
Like, is there any demand for Pac-12 football?
Well, right? Look, obviously Scott had a lot of problems in there, but you know, the problem with the underperformance of the conference isn't because they're paying too much commercial rent in the Embarcadero. It's nice that they're not doing that. Sure. I mean, the problem really is at the end of the day is you have a whole bunch of institutions that have not prioritized football the way that schools in the Big Ten and the SEC and the Big 12, quite frankly, have. You have a lot of schools that aren't willing to spend the money to, you know, you had a situation in Colorado, right? Where they have a kind of a nice season with Mel Tucker at coach, and he's immediately poached by Michigan State.
Right.
You know, and then they hired Carl Durrell to replace him. I mean,
right.
Like that's almost the kind of thing that just looks like it's not a serious situation, right? It doesn't look serious. Mike Leach getting poached, that's not the biggest shocker, but Washington State's got to be able to hold on to a guy like a Pac-12 school cannot have their coach get poached by one of the worst teams in a different conference, even if it is the SEC. You can't have a successful coach for your conference getting poached like that. You know, there's, you can almost go, you can go right down the list of every coach in the conference and say, what other conference would this guy have anywhere near this level of job? Right. You know, the situation at Cal, I mean, we kind of belabor the point with how bad Cal has been in terms of their athletic department, how there's no money anymore, but you know, this was a bottom of the barrel, higher for them as far as just how much it was going to cost them to get Will Cox as their head coach. I think he's actually done a decent job considering the support they've given him. But, you know, Cal was a program that not that long ago was competing with USC for like being the preeminent team in the conference. Now, I guess I'm getting older, but I mean, you know, there are lots of NFL players the last 20 years that went to Cal, and now they're kind of like a complete afterthought. During the COVID season, they only played four games. I mean, it's just kind of crazy. Which means since 2019, they've only won six games, you know, like, so
yeah,
it's, it, And Wilcox is, you know, a guy who got fired from USC as the defensive coordinator. So, you know, it's just kind of like, there's not been an adequate demonstration of seriousness and financial commitment other than by, like, say, Oregon in the conference.
So I agree with that 100%, but let's game this out a few years, right? So if we look at this year, I think USC has a decent chance to make the playoff. You know, reasonable minds can agree and disagree on that, but I look at their schedule with the Pac-12 adopting the new rule that the top two teams now go to the conference championship and not the North winner and the South winner. They basically have to split with Utah and win their other games to go to the playoff. Cause I think if they're 12-1 and have one loss to Utah, and they beat Notre Dame, I think a 12-1 Pac-12 team would get selected for the playoff. A one-loss conference champion, I don't believe, has gotten left out. In some of the, you know, debatable years, you had Alabama getting in as a second SEC team with one loss as a non-conference champ, but the other alternative was a two-loss Ohio State conference champ. So the precedent for a one-loss conference champ getting left out of the college football playoff, it just doesn't happen. So
it did happen with TCU one year, though, didn't it?
Right. So that was the year that Baylor and TCU were named co-champions by the Big 12, each had one loss.
And there was no conference championship game.
So they declared them co-champions, and then the committee took Ohio State as a one-loss Big Ten champ. So
yeah.
That was a very rare case, but
yeah.
I think if TCU were declared a conference champion that year, they probably would have gotten in. But the Big 12 screwed up by doing the, you know, equality thing, the parity, right? So they named them co-champs, and neither ended up getting in. So that's too bad for TCU. Like, they, I think beat Ole Miss in their bowl game by like 50 points or something. That was a really good TCU team. Mm-hmm. But, you know, even if USC doesn't make the playoff this year, you know, we look at next year, I think, you know, you and I would both agree the gap between USC and the rest of the Pac-12 will only increase in the next couple of years, right?
With Lincoln
getting his players in, right? The rest of the Pac-12 not taking football seriously. It's just going to be a bigger gap between USC and the rest of the conference. So if that's the case, USC should be able to make the playoff, you know, pretty consistently over the next couple of years, in my mind, right?
Yeah, so it would be similar to what's happened with Oklahoma, right, where they've made it mm-hmm. pretty consistently.
Yes.
Not every right. year, but like two out of every 3 years. I'm looking, the TV deal does not expire until 2024. So we have three more seasons left under this TV deal. SC can't really leave the conference before that because they wouldn't own their own TV rights. So that would be a little bit, that would be problematic. So they kind of got to wait for that to happen. Once that happens, you know, I'm not sure what direction we're going, but yeah, SC could conceivably make it in to, well, here's a couple of things, right? SC could definitely make it in as, you know, let's say two of the next 3 years or something crazy to make college football playoff.
Yeah.
But SC could still be in a situation where their revenues from football are way below everybody, all the other major powers, because they're having to do this split, you know, this parity split inside the conference with 11 of the schools that are not generating nearly enough revenue. So,
I agree with that. And what I would say that even if USC does, you know, bring in less revenue than the other college football powers, which I think is absolutely true, if they're still getting to the playoff, from a fan's perspective, if you're a fan and you don't care about the revenue, you just care about championships, like getting the playoff gets you a shot, right? Even if you're bringing in way less revenue, and you know, I'm sure the higher ups at USC wouldn't be thrilled,
I guess my question is, will over time that become an issue? If can SC stick it out in a situation where, you know, they've committed to pay Riley X amount of dollars? Now there's also talk that Wayne Hughes is a state picked up part of that tab, which is interesting.
Okay. Yeah.
For that, because you know, it's not just the cost of Riley's himself; it's the staff, which he had some demands for the staff, and then you have like I know they're doing weight rooms and weight room improvements. I'm sure there's a couple things to mention. One is I had gone to a kind of a booster dinner a couple years back with Lynn Swan, and Swan, I mean, amongst the many kind of other crazy things he said, including how Clay Helton is a great football coach, and he kept repeating that and simultaneously telling us, he was really fixated. Lynn Swan was very fixated on the small size of revenue being generated from the conference. He kept repeating it. He clearly thought they needed to get out. Now, I don't think Lynn Swan is a financial genius, but I think it's pretty obvious. Like, you're being choked off revenue wise. He didn't have somebody writing a $100 million check to bring Lincoln Riley in. So he felt, I think, a little boxed in by the situation. Now the irony here is Lynn Swan was probably only in that position to begin with, because of Wayne Hughes and how close Lynn Swan is with Wayne Hughes' daughter, as friends, they're very close friends. So I guess maybe in death, Wayne Hughes realized how bad of a decision he had made in forcing Nikias's hand to hire Swan. And the result was that now there's, $100+ million to hire Lincoln Riley. So all of that is possible. All of that is possible.
Even at that time, was USC still locked into this crap Pac-12 network exclusive deal?
Yes, because
so it was like a long-term thing, right?
It was a long-term thing. I mean, Hayden had negotiated, but he had got in on this and was so excited because what happened was the Pac-12 was first to the table and had the biggest deal of the time. And, not realizing stupidly that, everybody else seeing that the precedent set by this deal and the value of having live sports, everyone else would outdo the Pac-12. And that's exactly what happened. And Hayden, I think, to his great detriment, and because he is supposed to be a finance guy, signed on for a complete parity split, 1/12, because he thought the money was, there'd be so much money. So it was, people warned him, smart financial people warned him at the time, do not take this long-term parity split deal. And he ignored them and took it anyway. And that's we still have 3 years to go on that kind of, it's just interesting.
Right.
So anyway, look, the truth is, what you're saying is completely right, that it's very possible that stuff could happen. A few things break the right way, and SC makes the college football playoff here, very early in Lincoln Riley's tenure. I do think, though, over the long run, the revenue side is just will reflect how well you can build up the program. And that's going to be now. I've also heard separately that there is lots of money for NIL going forward. So that's kind of a separate piece of this, but as he's going to handle it in a way that they want to be very careful, which, makes some sense.
Yeah. Right. So if you're just looking at it from, the perspective of, the long-term trajectory of revenue is going to hinder the long-term trajectory of the program. I guess the counter to that is, if they make the playoff in, let's say, 2 out of the next 3 years, I don't know what years, but like they're a consistent winner, they make it twice, maybe they make the championship game once, maybe they win it all, who knows, right? But if you're making the playoff, you have a good program. So they make it 2 out of the next 3 years. And then at that point, they've got the chance to renegotiate this Pac-12 TV deal. And I think it's pretty clear that Bone and Sozna would not take the moronic approach that Hayden took and accept the 12 team share with an exclusive deal to the Pac-12 network, right? So at that point, you could get a legitimate increase in your revenue by getting out of that deal, essentially. And if you get, if you get a massive revenue increase in 2025, or whatnot, that can help fund your program and facilities moving forward in like the years 2026 to 2035 or something.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So
I could definitely see that. I would be, I'm curious at how this is all going to play out, what SC is going, what demands SC is going to make. You know, one of the deals they have in the SEC is there is complete parity split on the on shared revenue, but the conference only gets the revenue split only applies to conference games. So all the home games, you can go, you get whatever revenues flow from those to keep for yourself, which is kind of explains a lot of the scheduling and why it's so important many times that, you know, the SEC team scheduling in a way that they can generate lots of revenue from their out of conference games, either playing at home or playing one of these like, you know, third party location games like USC played with Alabama at Jerry's World in Dallas. So yeah, we'll have to see how that plays out. All right. Well, you want to talk about the schedule, go through the schedule and then.
Let's do it. Let me pull it up on my end. So we start with Rice.
Yeah. So and then this
Owls
is
from my neck of the woods.
Yeah. So, and this is for the debut of Lincoln Riley right on the Pac-12 network. So there we go. I think SC will win this game. But it will become really interesting really quickly, right? Because even though Stanford's been down recently, and I don't necessarily think they'll be great next season. SC, this is always a tough game for SC. SC's had some success, but, you know, they're not walkovers. And, of course, the Stanford just kind of shellacking SC last year got Clay Helton fired. So, at Stanford, I'm guessing you're picking SC here?
I am. I actually think David Shaw is a horrible coach. I think he doesn't recruit. He offers recruits late. Stanford's a decent program. I think they get a lot of kids are interested in going there because of the academics, and Shaw just isn't putting the work in and hasn't gotten the results. So, I mean, he was able to beat Clay Helton, but, you know, whoop-de-doo. I think SC kind of blows him out there.
Okay. Fresno State, back at the Coliseum. Game is on Fox on the Saturday night. Saturday night game at the Coliseum, that's going to be a little bit tough for Fresno State, probably.
I think so. Hayner can really spin it. He had that kind of...
He's a great quarterback. I really like Hayner.
Yeah. Yeah, he had that kind of Superman performance against UCLA where he was really hurt and kind of willed them on that last drive. So I could see them scoring. I just don't know how Fresno State stops Williams. So that kind of feels like a, you know, 50-30 game to me.
Yeah, I mean, to me, I could be like 55-52 as far as I know. I mean, but
it's possible. Yeah.
I think playing, you know, that late game in LA, you know, I have a feeling it's just going to, well, we'll see. We'll see. Obviously, when the legendary Reggie Bush game was a Saturday night game against Fresno State. Late in the season, though, unlike this one. Okay, SC then goes up to Corvallis. This could be a tricky game. You know, Oregon State was probably the best it's been in quite a while last season. You know, now we got a game on Saturday. We don't know when exactly it's going to be. I'm hoping it's a day game, but, you know, Beaver Stadium. Is it called Beaver? No, it's called Riser Stadium, right? Riser Stadium. Any thoughts here?
Yeah, it's going to be the game that everybody picks as the trap game, right? Because it's a road game sandwiched between home games. Oregon State flashed last year. Oregon State demolished USC last year. I tend to think that USC won't lose these guys in consecutive years. I think there's a massive talent gap, but Jonathan Smith's a good coach. So, you know, I like SC, but you never know what could happen.
Yeah, these are games don't necessarily look like easy ones. Following week, Arizona State at Coliseum. I think SC wins that for fun. Arizona State's kind of a program in disarray.
Yeah, it's a blowout. Their best defensive player or two best defenders transferred out. I think they had like 15 players transfer out. A lot of them were contributors. And in fact, like one of their freshman All-American defender transferred to USC. So, that's a blowout, I think.
Okay, Washington State at home. You know, Washington State was actually pretty good last year, but this was SC's like one big win. You know, I think playing it at the Coliseum, USC usually beats Washington State at the Coliseum. I did go to the game where I think it was John Robinson's last year where Ryan Leaf beat SC at the Coliseum, but it doesn't happen too often.
Yeah. Washington State also, they're going through a quarterback transition. So their old starter, Jaden Delora, transferred to Arizona. But they did get a pretty high profile quarterback transfer. I think Cameron Ward, I want to say he went to like Incarnate Word or something. He's a Division III guy. Incarnate. I think it was Incarnate Word. So, but he put up like major numbers and is getting like a decent amount of hype. So they got some talent at the quarterback position. But I just, you know, the rest of the roster is just a talent mismatch. So, and with it being at the Coliseum, I think you have to like USC.
Yeah. So now we got at Utah here. This is, I think a lot of people have circled this as maybe the toughest looking game, at least on paper, October 15th in Salt Lake.
Yeah, I guess I'll pick Utah. You gotta, I think, pick them to lose one of these games. I don't think you can pick them to go undefeated. I do think Utah has a lot of holes. They gave up, you know, like 50 or something in the Rose Bowl to Ohio State. Ohio State had their they had several starters out. Their two top receivers who went in the top 12 sat out the Rose Bowl. Their best defensive tackle sat out the Rose Bowl, and one of their starting tackles sat out the Rose Bowl, and they still had no problem moving the ball on Utah in the second half. Utah loses Devin Lloyd, their best defensive player. They do return a good amount of their offense with Cam Rising, so I think they will score. I think USC might be a little bit soft in their front seven. Not as soft as last year, but you know, I can see Utah running on USC in Salt Lake City. They have a good crowd there at Rice-Eccles. So I'll take Utah in that one.
Okay, so now we got three in a row here that I really think is the softest part of the schedule. Down in Tucson, yeah. And then you got home against Cal, home against Colorado. SC should be major favorites in all three of those games.
I think that's right. I would watch out for Arizona there. I think Fish is a really good coach. He did a good job in the portal. He got a 5-star receiver from Servite. And there's like legitimate buzz there right now. Definitely a better coach than Sumlin. So I would watch out for that one on the road, especially if they win against Utah the prior week and are coming off a high.
Okay.
Actually, I take that back. They do have a bye week. So okay. That kind of makes it, I'm a little more confident in that game with the bye week.
Okay. So we got UCLA, we got Notre Dame to finish up the season at UCLA. And then SC comes back and plays at home against Notre Dame.
I'll take SC in both of them. Both are losable. Do think they have a talent mismatch against the Bruins at the Rose Bowl. And Notre Dame, USC historically has done pretty well against Notre Dame at the Coliseum. They really tend to struggle out in South Bend. So I'll take SC in both of those games, but both are losable.
Okay. So I am going to go, oh, and then we have the Pac-12 championship. So I'm going to go with SC. I think you got an early season loss to Oregon State. I think, probably Utah, and then maybe Notre Dame in the season. They still have SC 7-2 in conference. Maybe in the Pac-12 championship game against Oregon. You definitely have USC in the Pac-12 championship game. You think they're playing Oregon, Utah? Who do you think they're in there with?
I think it's a rematch against Utah, and USC wins the rematch.
Okay. All righty. All right. You got anything else before we get out of here?
Shoot. No, I think I kind of hammered out a lot here. So I am at 12-1 with a loss to Utah. And Chase, are you at 9-3 or 10-2?
I'm at 9-3. I think if SC plays in the Pac-12 championship game, I think SC has a chance to win that, even at 9-3. So, but I'm not going to pick that right now, but I'm at 9-3.
Yeah. And the thing is on these games, right? Like if you're picking a game by game, like the expected win value is going to be less than just going game by game, right? Because these are all percentage, picked on a percentage basis. So like I could say, I think they're favored in every game on the schedule and the expected wins would be like 10-2 or 11-1, right? Yeah. So you have to look at it that way, that even if, you know, I think they might be legitimately favored in every game this year, but that doesn't mean like, you know, they're a greater than 50% chance to make the playoff. But I do think they have a very good shot at it.
Yeah. All righty. Well, we'll be back sometime in the coming days here shortly after June 4th. Any predictions for what Boogie Ellis and Drew Peterson are going to do?
I think they return. What do you think?
I think they both return too.
I hope so.
Well, I mean, yeah, I'm not sure. I mean, Drew is actually, you know, played 4 years of college basketball. So it's not a total shock that he would leave. But I still think he's probably going to come back. Boogie, I would assume he's coming back. All right. Well, we'll figure out what happens and we'll have a podcast to talk about it.
We will. Yeah. Probably in another week or so. So yeah, we'll be back to basketball after the 1 week hiatus here.
All right. Until then, fight on, everyone.
Yeah. Fight on, guys.